Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today, we're here to discuss season two of one of our favorite costume dramas, The Gilded Age. We're excited to track all the drama between Team New Money and Team Old Money as they fight for power in New York's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we're cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories. And you know what? We also love us a good period piece, too. We kicked off our coverage last time we were covering period pieces with The Gilded Age. So we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes' newest project with more in-depth analysis of season two of The Gilded Age. You can find our episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, and The Crown on your podcast feeds.
We're very excited to spend each week catching up with the Russells and the Van Ryn clan and all the many rich characters in this costume drama.
Drama. Emphasis on drama.
Emphasis. This week, we'll be scandalized by the return of Turner. And again, her mama called her Turner, I'ma call her Turner. Okay?
Not Mrs. Winterton, Mr. Winterton?
No. No. We're going to go to a very terrible Oscar Wilde play. Very bad.
Yeah.
Awful. Well. And learn about the watercolors of Adolf Menzel in season 2, episode 3, Head to Head.
Speaking of that, like Aunt Ada and Bannister, we have combed through numerous receipts, and Kin Folklore will have adult content on the menu, full of tea parties where a new flavor called Marital Omissions is being served. And luncheons at the Van Ryan's where clams are being served as well. You know they're an aphrodisiac. And who said watercolors can't be sexy? Not on Ada. She's all about it. Let's go. So when we kick this thing off, this episode begins with the Russells hosting a tea party so that Mrs. Russell can recruit some of the Academy members to buy boxes in both opera houses. Among the guests is Turner. The house is abuzz. They're like, holy crap, it's Turner, whose husband has been climbing up the social standing because they spent their honeymoon courting English nobles. Turner and Mrs. Russell have some words, and Turner alludes to something that we've known since season one, but she has no idea about, that something may have occurred between her and Mr. Russell. We're going to talk about this.
I have so much to say about this.
Yeah.
I could write a dissertation about this. Anyway, this has been a problem for me since season one, but I also don't understand what Turner is playing at.
Me either. It's kind of just wild. Like, I don't think she has an end game, obviously. She's not the most adept at strategy, it seems like. She's definitely not a match for Mrs. Russell. Let's put it that way. And so this does lead to a fallout between George and Bertha. And later in the episode, Mr. Russell's having some other problems. Lots of issues.
This is a rough episode. Like, it's just rough.
Yeah. Is, you know, little thing called labor unions causing a little ruckus with his, capitalist enterprise. And, he invites the leader of this union, Mr. Henderson, to a luncheon so that he can make him an offer of a management position. He puts him up at a nice hotel. He has his man, give him the greatest accommodations, invites him to the house. And while grateful for the hospitality that Mr. Russell and the Russell family has offered, and even though Bertha comes through, even though she's pissed at him, Mr. Henderson is out. He's like, I got no interest in leaving the union. You miscalculated. I'm not the guy you think I am. Meanwhile, Mr. Russell's valet, Watson, meets with his son-in-law, Robert McNeil, a real, interesting fellow, I'll put it that way. McNeil makes him an offer to move to the West Coast, where he will be well taken care of and never contact his daughter or grandchildren again. Obviously, this hits Watson pretty tough. Not really like that. You know, nice, like he says, a fair offer, but still cruel. Still very cruel. So that's where we are with Team New Money.
Well, across the street at Team Old Money's headquarters, Mrs. Astor visits with the Van Ryan clan and asks Agnes to send a threat to all the members of the Academy. If you take a box at the Met, you will lose your place in the Academy. wild stuff, Mrs. Astor.
Can we just talk about the threat and that freaking Ward rolls up in here like double dipping on the action?
When he like snuck across the street, I laughed so hard.
Oh my God.
It was so funny. But we can talk more, but like Bertha's out here trying to charm people and Mrs. Astor's like, you will lose your box.
Yeah, what did your girl say? Like, I'm gonna get out of here before the guns come out. Yeah. Oh my God. That's great.
Ida tells Agnes that she would like to invite the rector over for luncheon. And Agnes takes the opportunity to tell her that she plans on inviting Dashiell since he would like to court Marion. At lunch, Mr. Forte and Ida bond over their love of watercolors. Peggy continues to make her case to Mr. Fortune about going with him to cover the new dormitory at the Tuskegee Normal School for Colored Teachers. He agrees eventually. However, both Marion and Dorothy Scott warn Peggy about the different dangers of her traveling to the South. At Aurora's invitation, Marion, Dashiell, Mrs. Beaton, Gladys, and Larry Russell. Oh, and John Adams. This was like, Aurora invited like 15 people to this thing.
Aurora Fane is going to throw a party. If it's something to be done, she's going to figure it out. Even if fuck shit is going to happen, she's figuring it out. Anyway.
She invites them all to see Oscar Wilde's newest play. The play is awful, as we mentioned earlier, and they all struggle to make conversation with Mr. Wilde at the reception. Marion agrees at the same time to accompany Frances, Dashiell's daughter, to a mother-daughter tea at school when Dashiell tells her that Frances has been sad. Finally, Aunt Ada and Mr. Forte go on a date.
Yes!
They go to look at Eldolf Menzel's watercolors, and it's super cute.
Yes, Agnes, I know you meant to call her out, but she actually does know some watercolor painters that she really admires, including the work of Mr. Menzel.
Imagine Agnes thinking it's appropriate to gatekeep watercolors.
Oh man, shout out to Marion for being her like co-conspirator and getting her out to the date. It's really cool.
I love how the relationship between Marion and Ada has developed. They are such good allies to each other. I love it.
Yeah, I love it too. I really love it too. And yeah, let's talk about it, man. Let's start with what we really the real thing here. Battle of heavyweights, Mr. and Mrs. Russell going at it. What? Why does he? I said it last episode. This guy stays lying about the wrong shit. Like, he just lies, like, for no reason. Like, it's crazy. Like, what does he not understand? What are you thinking about with this whole thing? What do you want to talk about with this?
Okay. This is a bombshell, right?
Yeah.
And I just don't think that George Russell like is acknowledging how serious it is, and then he's expecting Bertha to just be like, I forgive you because you said you're sorry. A woman got into your bed naked, tried to seduce you, which is a betrayal of your wife, and then you say nothing and allow this woman to continue to be in your wife's confidence. Like, the bond between a lady's maid and a lady is, like, it's, like, you can't even explain it. This woman literally, like, sees all of your worst moments. Like, it is so much more important than just having someone who, like, understands how to act, which is the main reason I think that he wanted to keep Turner around, was, like, Turner was helping Mrs. Russell, like, navigate the culture. Mm-hmm. She clearly can't be trusted. Okay, so that was his first sin, not saying anything. But then his second is being kind of dismissive of his wife's upset over this, because Turner obviously weaponized it. And once he recognized that Mrs. Winterton was Turner, why didn't he say something then? So she could at least be prepared, but instead allows Turner to weaponize it against his wife, and then she's learning about this third party when she should have learned about it from him.
And he left like a lot of room for there to be doubt where there should have been none. Like mm-hmm. if he proactively goes and says, that's what I mean, he's lying about the wrong shit. If he proactively goes and is like, okay, this lady's out of here, because being a partner, right, or being like in that, and even in that time period, being in that situation where really, if you look at them, the Russells operate a lot differently than even we're used to seeing in older period pieces. Like, and because, you know, Bertha's really like giving some of her money to some of the things that for whatever her family background is, that some things that have helped him, like in last season when he needed money to fix the situation that he was in. So I feel like he should have said to her, like, yo, this is what happened. And he kind of took it upon himself, his hubris, that he was making the right call, that he was doing the honorable thing, that he was like, it was his ego. Like, he could have easily just said, listen, this is what happened. If you choose to keep her, I'll stand by it. I, you know, nothing happened, and just left it at that. But he didn't give her the option or the choice. He just made a unilateral decision for both of them that didn't need to be made in that fashion. Like, it just didn't. Like, he could have like literally told his wife that same night and lessened the chance of scandal. And also lessened the chance of her becoming Mrs. Winterton, because it would have been everywhere that that's who she was.
Agreed. And she would have left without a reference. So there's that. Then there's this other piece of this, which is like, what is Turner playing at here? Like, there's no way to weaponize this against Mrs. Russell without also making herself look bad. Because first she has to admit that she was Mrs. Russell's lady's maid. Then she has to say that she tried to seduce her husband. Like, I don't understand what Turner's playing at here. Is she threatening and saying, I will have like a scorched earth approach? I don't believe you, ma'am. Okay. I don't believe you, because you're out here trying to be Mrs. Winterton. So I don't understand what Turner even thinks she's doing here.
I think she's like blinded by her anger towards this lady. The whole jumping in the bed and everything was just, she wants to be her. And so to me, it's just about, it's not even a rational, I think, you know, there's no real, I don't think she has a game plan. I think it's just like, I'm going to one up you. I'm going to make you feel small because I had to feel small all the years that I was your lady's maid.
I mean, okay, but how is that going to serve you now as Mrs. Winterton? Yeah. I don't get it.
Me neither.
But back to George, I just, all of the things he says to her are wrong. And like, in his wanting to gain her forgiveness, he just keeps downplaying it. Like, it was a stupid mistake. I'm sorry if it was a bad decision. Dude, you messed up really badly. And you need to give her the time and space to like figure it out. It's like the next day he's like, you're not having dinner with me?
That was the part. The part is like, he's all like, so how long is this going to go on? Like, it just happened this morning, bro. Like, it just literally went this morning.
Like,
it was just
like
this,
this is like luncheon. Yeah. Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah. Anyway.
But you got to give one person in the Russell clan their props for knowing how to leverage a situation. She comes by those Russell jeans real, real good. Gladys was like, yo, can I go to Mr. Wild's play? And she was like, yeah, go ahead. I don't care. She's like, what? No fight? And she was like, you know what? Let me get out of here. She was shocked, but she got out of there quick. She was like,
I also had another question about this interaction, because Gladys is like, can I go? And her mom's like, yeah, whatever. And then she's like, John Adams will be escorting me. And she's like, uh-huh. Good stuff. Man. It reminds me of like every time I wanted my mom to agree to something as a teenager, I would wait until she was like working from home. You know, like she would bring work home and I would wait until she was like deep in her notes and I'd be like, yeah, so I'm going to stay out to midnight tonight. And she'd be like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Mr. Russell, like, your mother's not feeling well. No, no, no. She's feeling just fine. She's just got all of her focus on her anger towards you right now. All of her focus is there. And why is she pulling a Tywin? What the fuck letter is she writing right now?
Oh, I think, wait, was this the...
She's writing.
She's writing to.
Well, we probably can't say yet, but there's somebody she's writing to for sure. Like, oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I don't think we can say. I don't think we have full disclosure. We have seen the next episode, so I don't think what we should say because.
Pulling her best.
As Paul said, this is a Tywin Lannister move.
This is a Tywin Lannister move. Like, she is out here pulling a full Tywin. Oh, man. Good shit. Anyway, and then like, let's go over across the street. So, the rector's in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And Agnes is, like, really, like, in preparation. When Ada's wanted to invite, she's like, we have to have him drone on all Sunday morning. Can the Lord really want more than that? Yo, classic fucking Agnes. Oh, my God.
She was so good this episode. She was also catch me when Marion was like, I was rearranging a classroom. So you're moving
furniture now? Oh, it's so
like,
good.
It's like, ma'am, she moved a couple of flip desks around. It's not like she needed you know, workers' clothes. Like, she literally probably, like, moved a couple of things around the room.
Yeah.
Too funny.
I thought there was one thing at the play that was, speaking of Marion, that was really also another good moment and good lines from Oscar Wilde. When Marion, you know, is asking about the old world and the new world, and she's saying, you know, is the old world better? And Wilde said a really cool thing. He said, not better per se, just more tested by time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is I think that's an interesting take on it, right? I mean, it's an interesting way to think about it, and really in the context too of, like, you know, the world we experience in Downton and what happened, and the world we experience, we're experiencing here. It's all fresh. It's all new. It's all burgeoning.
And I think it just speaks to the sensibility of how the English often feel about Americans, mm-hmm. which is that Americans may have the power and the wealth, but we don't have the experience. The English have been through, you and I talk about this all the time in mm-hmm. the context of the Crown. Like, you're watching the fall of an empire just really slowly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm like, doesn't that kind of feel like now mm-hmm. with America? Mm-hmm. And I think he's just speaking to that, like, that sensibility of, it's not that it's better. Like, obviously, the English made tons of mistakes along the way and didn't always learn from their mistakes, but they're still around after all this time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of that, like, we're the older sibling. Like, we have been through a lot of this already.
But you're hitting on something that really stuck out to that line for me, was that I think about our current moment in history and our current moment right now and some of the struggles we're having and even just governing in America and things that are going on. And not to say that the English have had it all right, but I thought about, the English have been around, like, since back when, we're talking about, like, the Vikings and the first king of, like, you know, like England. And I mean, it's so freaking long that has been around, like the actual crown. That is just, like, it's kind of like you start thinking about how young we are as a country. You really do. You start, that line made me think about how young we are as a country and how young we are as a city. You know what I mean? Like, in New York City too. It's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I mean, yeah, like, I always think about with the Hamilton line of New York is the greatest city in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this period, like in the 1770s,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
New York is a fairly new city. It might be new and fresh and innovative and creative, but, like, the greatest city in the world, like, that's not a thing, right? And I think that hubris is sort of what gets America in trouble, and also is really at play in the Gilded Age, is just this notion of, like, you can kind of throw money at everything, but they're still dealing with these European conventions of who's in and who's out and birthright and all of those things. So I thought it was a really fascinating line to come from Oscar Wilde, who is an unconventional person who really struggled in mm-hmm. the, you know, the old world. Like, mm-hmm. not to say that his life would have been easier in America. I'm absolutely not saying that. But, like, Oscar Wilde was eventually jailed for being a homosexual. And, like, this is a really interesting statement to come from someone who 10 years after this is going to experience the injustice of that old world.
100%. And I thought it was really fascinating to see how he, as an outsider, was able to see all the intricacies of the relationships by observing.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Totally. Like, those who have seen or read The Importance of Being Earnest, like, this guy was very good at seeing society and seeing human behavior and making fun of it. So I'm not surprised that he's so intuitive about what is unfolding in his in front of him within minutes of knowing these people.
Yeah, no, and he goes, when the line that took me out was like, she says, oh, whatever do you mean? He says, oh, yes, you're way too well brought up to know what I'm talking about. I was like, yes, this shit is great. And Aurora Fane, yes, you're clueless. It's kind of crazy. Anyway.
I loved his look at John Adams, too.
Yeah.
It was so funny. He was like, hey.
It's so good. Oh man. So shall we discuss
the biggest scandal of this episode?
Yes. Yes.
The great clam chowder scandal of 1883.
Serving soup at luncheon? Who's eating soup at luncheon?
Oh my goodness. This was so funny. I actually think this bit went on a little bit too long, but it was funny in Agnes's initial response to it, when she's like, what is this? Why is it in front of me? And I swear Aurora like clutched her pearls when it was like, when Ida was like, it's soup. And she was like, at lunch?
How times have changed. Yes, soup is a totally appropriate lunch.
Like, the people who founded Hale and Hardy Soup Shop are probably like, our whole business is based on lunch. Like, Hale and Hardy used to be like the lunch spot when I worked in downtown Manhattan. So anyway, I thought it was very funny. I didn't know that was a thing. Like, honestly, it was something. I've watched so many of these period pieces and I didn't realize that soup was not to be served for luncheon.
Yeah, me neither. I was kind of surprised too, but it was a very sweet gesture, right? And it's like one of those, like, you know, winks that Aunt Ada's giving, you know, that, hey, I like you. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, hey, I went through the extra trouble, Mr. Forte, to figure out getting you something that you said you haven't been able to get since you've been in New York City. And I thought that was really sweet.
Yeah, me too. I mean, imagine his point of view. He said this in passing to her at their first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembered it. I thought it was so, so sweet to go through all that trouble to kind of also nod that, like, convention doesn't matter, right? Like, I know we're not supposed to have soup at lunch, but I'm going to do this for you because you said this is something you were looking for. So I just thought that was so sweet.
And yeah, there's a subtext too there, right? Like, I'm not so, like, pretentious that I can't do this, right? Right? Like there's like a humility to that as well of like, yeah, let's eat some soup. Like, it's like that kind of like, that would appeal to a man of the cloth. You know what I mean? Ada got game. You know what I mean? She got game. She ain't messing around. She knows what she came to do. You know? Mm-hmm. I'm with it. You know who else has game?
Don't say it. Don't do it.
I mean, she does though. Mrs. Blaine. And Larry, Larry's out here, like, you know, he's a little blindsided, he's a little blind, but he is like, you know, he's charming, and he also has some of his dad's qualities, because he totally doesn't get that while it's cool for him, he's playing with fire for this lady's reputation.
Paul, I can't, okay? If you could amplify my sigh so it is the most epic sigh. Every time these two are on screen, I'm like, what is the point of this? Like, why are we doing this? I don't want... End of last season told me that Larry and Marion were the perfect couple. Let's do this!
I'm ready for it, too. I'm so ready for it. There's so much romance in the air, but not the romance that we're looking for sure. Like it's
because he's spending all his time in Newport. I'm like, dude... I can't. And the thing that just makes me nuts about it is Larry is being so indiscreet. Like they have this conversation about discretion. He's worried about the servants. And then two scenes later, he's like, you know, let me take you home in front of everybody in the middle of this play. People obviously noted it. Like, what are you doing?
Especially Mrs. Beaton. Like she was like, that sounds exciting when she's talking about like them going home because she wasn't feeling well. She's like, oh, it sounds exciting. I was like, whoa, like it's a bad look. It's a bad, bad look.
Yeah. If she had a headache, she has a carriage. Let the carriage take her home. Like I don't, the notion that Larry would have to escort her home is so, like, it's so inappropriate. I just can't.
But one thing I did want to call out is that it's like, you know, never mind. Forget it. I'll hold that. Damn it. I keep conflating episodes. I was about to say something. I'll have to cut that out. But you know, yeah, I'm with you. I definitely think that it's really, really, really important that they keep this on the down low and he's not moving with the same discreet and it's causing too much attention. It's definitely, especially, you know, at a play, like a play is what really threw me off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and at that same play, talking about this thing we can't seem to work out with Larry and Marion, we really want it to happen, is Marion agrees to go to a mother-daughter tea? Like, this is when being too nice goes wrong. This is just way too much. I don't know that I would have done this.
Yeah, I think it's a sweet gesture for Francis. Okay. Here's where I think Marion doesn't have all the information we have, right? So we know from Agnes and Ada's conversation that Dashiell is interested in courting Marion.
Mm-hmm.
Marion doesn't know that. So when she's making this offer, she thinks she's doing her cousin, Francis, a favor. And she says to him, I've experienced what Francis is going through because my mother died quite young too.
Yeah.
So she's just trying to, I think, make a negative experience for Francis a positive one. But Dashiell's here looking at that and everything that she's done, like even like just calling out some random horse.
Yeah.
As like having deeper meaning. And I just think that if Agnes or Ada had a conversation with her and told her that Dashiell was trying to court her, maybe she wouldn't have made the offer, but knowing Marion, probably she would have made it anyway because she's just like a really sweet person, like even to her downfall a lot of the time. I think we're fine. We can move on to the Henderson Russell piece.
Yeah, which is a very big piece. I mean, Mr. Russell thinks he's laying out the red carpet and his tact is not fairness. His tact is bribery. Let's bribe this guy. Everybody has a price.
Mm-hmm. You know what this made me... This whole conversation between him and Henderson made me think of in Downton Abbey in season 2 when Branson and Sybil run off together and Robert tries to pay off Branson.
Yeah.
And Branson responds... That's the problem with men like you. You think you have the monopoly of honor.
Huh.
And I just, when Henderson was being like, oh, I see what you're doing here. It made me think about that. Cause I'm like, actually, I think the problem with Mr. Russell is that he thinks everyone is as dishonorable as he is. It's not that he thinks he has a monopoly of honor. He actually thinks the reverse, which is that everyone for enough money would make the compromises that he probably would have made when he was up and coming and wasn't super wealthy. And Henderson is just kind of like, no. And also, by the way, you might think I'm like dumb, but we're evenly matched. Like, you're not going to manipulate me. I see exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. 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 I loved his call out to this. I thought it was really, really great. And I think it shocks Mr. Russell a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, that he can't get through to him in that way. And it's, you know, advantage Mr. Henderson. He walks out of that. I think he wins that battle. You know what I mean? Like, for sure. And he notes, and I think that it's, even in that setting, you got to think Mr. Henderson's life is most likely not as opulent. That setting and everything, it'd be easy to say, oh my gosh, like, and just like, you know, go for the money. But he doesn't. He sticks to his morals and his ethics and what he wants. You know what I mean? For everybody, not just for himself. Because he realizes just getting it for himself is not enough. It still doesn't fix the problem. And he's more geared about fixing the problem, you know?
So. Yeah, totally. I will say one thing that I also thought was just remarkable about this whole exchange and everything that led up to it was how charming Mrs. Russell was.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's like really pissed at her husband, rightfully so, as we've already covered. But she speaks to Mr. Henderson with such respect. She compliments his wife. And she seems genuine.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, she's not putting on airs. Like, and it made me think to, like, how different this exchange would go if Mrs. Astor was in her place or if Agnes Van Ryn was in her place. Like, she seems genuinely interested in this man's life. And she doesn't seem to be condescending to him. And I'm just not sure that either Mrs. Astor or Mrs. Van Ryn would be able to pull this off. I think the fact that the Russells come from humbler, I don't think the Russells were ever working class. I think they were probably middle class. But they come from humbler backgrounds. It just makes it easier for them to move in more than one circle. But it's interesting to me that she treated Henderson with such respect. She does not treat her own servants with the same respect all the time. Like, I actually think that she can be quite disrespectful to her servants, whereas Mrs. Van Ryn seems to have a lot more respect for them. So it's just an interesting thing to call out. It was also kind of a tension in Downton Abbey as well.
Well, yeah, they kind of talk about Bertha's parents, I believe, like, where, like, if she, and it's, you know, if she's based on the Vanderbilts, like, they were farmers, right? Like, weren't they farmers of some sort in the middle of the country? Like, is that what they say? Is that for season one?
I don't recall. I don't want to say because I really don't recall. I don't think that she was from a poor background. I just don't think that she was well off.
Yeah. I mean, needless to say, whatever the background is, they probably had to, and they're still working, right? They're not like, you know, they're not like the Van Ryns over there, like, just living off of generational money, right? They're not needless to say, somebody was working to move into this stage of being part of, like, the nouveau riche. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, like, mm-hmm. that is still part of, like, you know, that's probably why they can respect. They're like, hey, these people could climb if they wanted to. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so it's interesting. It's an interesting exchange. I think it's setting up something here that, you know, unlike season one, where Mr. Russell was at war with people who had the same kind of ends as he had, and also from, like, wanted what they wanted, these people want something very different. Mr. Henderson, this foe, wants something very different. And so just bringing his previous foe to his knees by just, like, draining his money is not the same kind of, he's not going to be able to use the same tactics. You know what I mean?
Totally.
You know? Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. Very, very interesting to see that unfold. And then there's Peggy's situation, which I think is a very, very interesting one, because, like you said in the summary, she gets warnings from both Marion and from her mother. But Dorothy is concerned about something different than what Marion's concerned about. Like, Marion's concerned about how it looks in society to travel alone with a man. And yes, Dorothy's also concerned about that as her mother. But more, Dorothy's concerned about where she's trying to go.
Yeah, I thought this was a great way to just kind of show the complicated sort of how being both Black and a woman is complicated. Mm-hmm. So she has, if this were just Marion traveling to the South, it would be, the issue would be purely about the patriarchy and is it appropriate for a young single woman to travel with a older married man, which by their societal standards, it's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. Right. But Dorothy, Mrs. Scott, can't even get to that point when she's talking to her daughter because she's worried about violence. And I just thought that that was fascinating because it just kind of calls out. I think this was very intentional mm-hmm. to have Marion warn her and then to have Dorothy warn her in a of a different danger later in the episode. It's kind of the difference between being concerned about how people think of you and being concerned about your basic needs, like safety.
Yeah.
And it just sort of calls out that even though Dorothy Scott is like, let's say what it is. The Scots are wealthy.
Yeah, 100%.
These are wealthy Black folks. They have arrived, right? They have their own small business. They have servants. They're like, they're not, I wouldn't even say they're middle class. Like by the standards of the day, they're probably quite considered to be quite wealthy. And she's still fearful for her daughter to travel freely in this country because once she crosses that Mason-Dixon line, she, to me, when she said, once you cross that line, you are no longer human. I sat back because it's such a startling way to say something like that to your child. But it's like the talk, right, that Black parents have to have of their kids, which is like every situation is not safe for you.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was just really interesting that in a kind of roundabout way, the show kind of like played out intersectionality in the episode. And there's no like, you know, we were talking offline about how sometimes in these stories you get writers like throwing in a feminist rant or like mm-hmm. like taking modern sensibilities and putting them in the story. And that's not what happened here. Like these conversations, while separate, are both like work within the world that they've built because these are the rules that we understand are existed in the 1880s, right? The 1880s, we're really talking about, they're not even a full 20 years past the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So Peggy is probably a member of the first generation of Black people who were born and slavery was not the norm. That's, I got to hand it to the show for like not making her whole character about race, but also making it a American period piece that is confronting these really horrible parts of American history.
Yeah, 110%.
And not at the expense. Sometimes I'll stop talking about it in a second, but I just wanted to note one more thing. Sometimes what you see in American period pieces is they pick an issue. It is either about workers' rights mm-hmm. and immigrants' rights, or it is about the struggle of African Americans. Like if they're going to cover either topic, it's one or the other. I love that this show has such a scope that they're able to cover both.
Yeah, I agree. I totally, totally agree. And I think what I also love about it is they tackle this or starting to tackle this piece about traveling into the South in a time period that's not so far after the Civil War. And they also tackle the provincial nature of living in the Northeast as well as a Black person, like, right. Like there's still like this, they're in Brooklyn, right. And they're uh-huh. and everyone else is in, you know, Manhattan, Midtown to Uptown. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like, they're really Uptown, Upper West Side. Right. So that's like an interesting thing how they've started this process of like not letting the Northeast off the hook, but also at the same time, at the same time calling out what was happening in the South. So I think like this is an interesting approach that they're taking.
I totally agree. Cause I did not imagine this show would ever come even close to tackling this because it is in the Northeast.
Yeah. Agreed.
So they could have avoided it entirely.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I just thought that it was really interesting that Marion and Dorothy had totally different takes, but both see the danger here.
Yeah, me too. And the I guess not the last thing before we get into our, like, what Google, you know, like what we Googled for you. What do you think about this Watson McNeil piece? Like, you know?
Okay, so you know how I felt when we were watching it together, yeah. Which was, I was like, okay, just take the deal. Like, yeah. Take the deal. You know, I didn't know all of his story, right? I actually thought, to be honest, that he abandoned his kid.
Yeah.
Like, that was my initial piece, was like, oh, he abandoned his kid, and so you got to take your L's. Like, now you can't mess up her life, right? Mm-hmm. But then when he actually shares his story with Church, I was like, oh, no. Like, I'm sorry. He doesn't share it with Church first. He shares it with Mr. McNeil. Mm-hmm. But, like, this was a guy who made some mistakes. They were financial mistakes, and then was separated from his family because his father-in-law knew that he wasn't the most sound banker. Mm-hmm. That's horrible. And he doesn't deserve to be banished to the West Coast. Although I do think I agree this was a fair deal that was offered to him. You know, I don't think that it's unfair, and I also want to acknowledge Mr. McNeil gets that this would be a huge scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just trying to avoid that for his wife, for his kids, for everybody. Like, it's just, it would be in the newspapers. Like, this is a type of thing that could bring a lot of duress to their family. And Flora didn't do anything. She's a victim in this situation. So I think it's a tricky scenario. If I were Watson, I would probably take the deal. But to be separated from your child and your grandchildren forever for something that, like, while was your mistake, wasn't a family mistake that he made. He made a financial mistake that maybe wouldn't have been as devastating as if his father-in-law had not decided that he couldn't take part in his wife's inheritance. So, like, the part that separated him from his family is not his mistake.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I just feel like this guy, since last season, has wanted to see and check in on his daughter. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and I just think like, that to me, you got to hold out. You got to, like, figure out if there's another option than just, like, for the second time being like, okay, I guess I'll just give up my kid again. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, even as fair as the deal is, you know what I mean? Like, which he says, which he acknowledges, it's a fair deal. You know what I mean? Like, he acknowledges that it's a fair deal.
Yeah. And Church seems to think, like, you know, it's fair and maybe he should take it.
Yeah.
But I also can see his point of view. He obviously loves Flora, and he was willing to love her quietly from a distance. Like, yeah, he wasn't pushing himself in her life. He was just keeping track of her.
Yep.
I feel for Watson. I really do. Like, my whole perspective on him switched in the middle of this episode when I learned more about what separated him from his daughter to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. So you want to talk about what we Googled for the audience to look up?
Oof. So I was really stuck on this play because I've only ever really known Oscar Wilde as being like a great writer.
Yeah. And everybody's like, it sucks. Yeah, exactly.
And so the, like, snippets that they showed of the play, I was like, what even is this? Like, I had so many feels. It seemed like, I'm going to date myself a little bit. Anyone who saw the 90s version of Little Women, there are these scenes where they're performing Joe's plays, and there's, like, a count, and, like, it's, like, just over dramatic kid stuff. They're kids, right? Mm-hmm. That's what this play looked like to me. It looked like kid stuff with money behind it. So I got really stuck on it, and it turned out that this was a play called Vera. It's also known as The Nihilist. There's very little about this on the internet, actually. Like, it was buried because it was bad. This is actually Oscar Wilde's first theatrical production.
Wow.
And he debuted it, just like in the show, in New York City at Union Square Theater. He actually had just wrapped up a lecture series in America and went back to England and then came back just for this. The show was really not well received. People hated it. The New York Herald called it long dramatic rot. Which is so savage.
Oh, that's savage. Oh my God, that's rough.
I really wanted to include the plot points of the play for everyone, but like it was, we would be here for like an hour because there's just like a lot of twists and turns. It's wild. You should go look it up because Wikipedia does have like an act by act summary. It's kind of funny. It was a tragedy that was inspired by the struggles of Tsar Alexander II, who was threatened by revolutionaries who wanted to assassinate him and eventually succeeded. Mm-hmm. The play starred an actress named Marie Prescott. This is actually what she's known for, which I was like, how tragic that she's known for this. And she produced it as well with her husband, William Pertzall, who later said of the play was withdrawn simply because it did not pay. He said he lost $2,500, which is the equivalent of $76,000 today.
Jeez.
On this play in the week that it was on Broadway. Well, I guess it was not on Broadway, but the week that it was being shown. Wilde went on to write, like 7 or 8 years later, The Importance of Being Earnest and The Picture of Dorian Gray, which is a novel, not a play. But, you know, it just goes to show that even if your first thing doesn't succeed, try again. Imagine if Oscar Wilde got like savaged by the U.S. press, went home to lick his wounds and was like, I guess I shouldn't be a writer anymore.
Oh, my God. That's
like, I think two of the most important pieces of literature to come out in the earlier half, in the later half of the 18th century wouldn't have, the 19th century wouldn't have come out. So, you know, good for him for persisting.
Yeah, no, it's very good for him, especially after somebody calls your work wild, dramatic rot. Like that is crazy. That is super wild. I mean, I didn't Google this, but I did want to mention it. This, I think it really, it's about Mr. Henderson's character. And I mentioned it to you when we were offline. And more than like drawing any comparisons, I think like one of the things that I thought about was this documentary that I'd been watching. It's out there on PBS about, on YouTube. That's a PBS special about the Gilded Age. And there was a quote that was said by a guy named Henry George, who ran for mayor, beat out Theodore Roosevelt for mayor, which is kind of wild, of New York City. And he was the writer of a book called Progress and Poverty, which kind of, in some ways, I don't know, I haven't read the whole book, but I've like read summaries and blurbs from it. But the overall arching thing is about strategies that he was proposing on how to prevent business from creating this system of that forced people into unemployment and poverty, and kind of what, like, some ways the conflict that we see brewing between Henderson and Mr. Russell. And the quote was really, really profound to me, because it's when he was running for mayor, he was giving a speech and he was going around and he said, "Look at our vast city. And what do we see? On one side, a very few men, richer than is good for men to be. And on the other side, a great mass of men and women struggling, worrying, and wearying to get the most pitiful living. Is this by the will of the divine creator? No, it is the fault of men." And it was interesting because I think like different characters, it's not based, I don't have anything to say this is what it's based on, but what I think is interesting is that we're seeing that in this time in the Gilded Age of vast wealth, there is also a very clear delineation between the haves and the have-nots starting, and that the people who are, what we've seen most times in period pieces is the aristocracies and, you know, the upstairs, downstairs, and everybody's pretty well, but I love that they're introducing this information with Henderson. It really is, I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes.
Yeah, and I think it's an, first of all, that quote could have been said by Senator Bernard Sanders 5 minutes ago.
Well, interestingly enough, Henry George, like in that book, coined the phrase the 1%. He called these people and the Vanderbilts and the people of the world the 1%.
Yeah, I mean, these inequalities still exist today. We never quite figured out how to deal with them. In one of the episodes, I do want to talk about some of the things that Americans imported from Europe and maybe should have rethought during the revolution. I don't think that's the time for that is like this episode, but I think it's a really important call out because this period is a time where people are really kind of reckoning with that there's a cost to having all of this growth, right? That the Gilded Age is the Gilded Age because it was a financially good time for the United States. Manufacturing was at all-time highs. Like, we have railroads being built, we have exporting our resources, but at the same time, just like during slavery, there's a human cost that isn't always acknowledged. And what I liked about the conversation between Henderson and Mr. Russell was that they're both acknowledging that one just cares more than the other, right? Mm-hmm. So like Mr. Russell is acknowledging, should we not have made the Brooklyn Bridge because men died while building it? And I think that Mr. Henderson is saying, no, we should still do those things, but we have to do them better. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that it's been like we've figured that piece out. You know, I think we're still doing things that are very exploitative of our human capital. And so this part really resonated, and I'm sure this is why it's kept, like, this is why they're going on this route, because it does kind of resonate with the time we're in now, where people are increasingly frustrated by the inequalities.
Yeah, no, 110%. I was struck in the documentary when I was watching it that before he wrote this book, Progress in Poverty, he was destitute with a small family, had no money, and he was in the street. And he asked the guy for $5 and the person gave it to him. And he wrote that he marveled at like the fact that he was in such a desperate state that if the person would not have given it to him, he might have killed that person for the $5. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that's where he was. And then he realized, well, how could this be with all this land and all this prosperity and all that this place is, that I could feel that desperate and somebody else could just like nonchalantly just give me the $5. And that's what led him to this thought process of unpacking this and writing this book that eventually became very successful.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, just interesting tidbits, good stuff online to look up about the Gilded Age. Tons still out there and tons that's relevant for today. So we're so happy to be on this journey with you all. And, yeah, thanks for listening in, for enjoying this season with us. Reach out to us on Kin Folklore Pod on all of our socials, or you can hit us up at kinfolklore@gmail.com, and we will see you next week.
Bye, everyone.